their first impressions. In effect, for now, for us, both are true at once. Ahead of us, the path seems to fork, but it's forked already. In any event, there will be a visit. She reaches up to a cupboard for the tin of ground coffee and the filter papers, runs the cold water tap, fills a jug, fetches a spoon. Most of the cups are clean. She sets out, too. There's pathos in this familiar routine, in the sounds of homely objects touching surfaces, and in the little sigh she makes when she turns or slightly bends our unwieldy form. It's already clear to me how much of life is forgotten, even as it happens. Most of it. The unregarded present, spooling away from us. The soft tumble of unremarkable thoughts. The long-neglected miracle of existence. When she's no longer 28 and pregnant and beautiful, or even free, she won't remember the way she set down the spoon and the sound it made on slate, the frock she wore today, the touch of her sandal's thong between her toes, the summer's warmth, the white noise of the city beyond the house walls, a short burst of birdsong by a closed window. All gone already. But today is special. If she forgets the present, it's because her heart is in the future, the one that's closing in. She's thinking of the lies she'll have to tell, how they need to cohere and be consistent with Claude's. This is pressure. This is the feeling she used to have before an exam, a little chill in the gut, some weakness below the knees, a tendency to yawn. She must remember her lines. Cost of failure being higher, more interesting than any routine school test. She could try an old assurance from childhood. No one will actually die. That won't do. I feel for her. I love her. Now I'm feeling protective. I can't quite dispel the worthless notion that the very beautiful should live by other codes. For such a face as I've imagined for her, there should be special respect. Prison for her would be an outrage against nature. There's already nostalgia in this domestic moment. It's a treasure, a gem for the memory store. I've got her to myself, here in the ordered kitchen, in sunshine and peace, while Claude sleeps away the morning. We should be close, she and I, closer than lovers. There's something we should be whispering to each other. Perhaps it's goodbye. 18. In the early afternoon, the phone rings, and the future introduces herself. Chief Inspector Claire Allison, now attached to the case. The voice sounds friendly, no hint of accusation. That may be a bad sign. We're in the kitchen again. Claude has the phone. His first coffee of the day is in his other hand. Trudy stands close, and we hear both sides. Case? The word packs a threat. Chief Inspector? Also unhelpful. I gauge my uncle's anxiety by his zeal to accommodate.
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. Please do.
Chief Inspector Allison intends to visit us. Normal practice would be for both to come to the station for a chat, or to make statements if appropriate. However, due to Trudy's advanced condition, the family's grief, the Chief Inspector and a sergeant will come by within the hour. She'd like to take a look at the site of the deceased's last contacts. This last, innocent and reasonable to my ears, puts Claude into a frenzy of welcome.
Please come. Marvellous! Do take us as you find us. Can't wait. You'll...
She hangs up. He turns towards us, probably ashen, and says in a tone of disappointment,
Ah.
Trudy can't resist mimicry.
All fine, is it? What's this case? It's not a criminal matter.
He appeals to an imaginary audience, a council of elders, a jury. I hate it, my mother murmurs, more to herself, or to me, I'd like to believe. I hate it. I hate it.
This is supposed to be for the coroner.
Claude walks away from us, aggrieved, takes a turn around the kitchen, and comes back to us, outraged. Now his complaint is to Trudy.
This is not a police matter.
Oh, really? She says. Better phone the inspector and put her straight.
That poet woman. I knew we couldn't trust her.
We understand that somehow Elodie is my mother's charge, that this is an accusation. You fancied her.
You said she'd be useful.
You fancied her. But the deadpan reiteration doesn't needle him.
Who wouldn't? Who cares?
I do. I ask myself once more what I gain by their falling out. It could bring them down, then I'll keep Trudy. I've heard her say that in prison nursing mothers have a better life. But I'll lose my birthright, the dream of all humanity, my freedom. Whereas together, as a team, they might scrape through. Then give me away. No mother, but I'll be free. So which? I've been round this before, always returning to the same hallowed place, the only principled decision. I'll risk material comfort and take my chances in the wider world. I've been confined too long. My vote's for liberty. The murderers must escape. This is a good moment, then, before the Elodie argument goes too far, for me to give my mother another kick, distract her from squabbling with the interesting fact of my existence. Not once, not twice, but the magic number of all the best old stories. 3 times, like Peter's denial of Jesus.
Oh, 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 oh!
She almost sings it. Claude pulls out a chair for her and brings a glass of water.
You're sweating.
I'm hot. He tries the windows. They haven't budged in years. He looks in the fridge for ice. The trays are empty in the recent cause of 3 rounds of gin and tonics. So he sits across from her and extends his cooling sympathies. It'll be all right.
No, it won't.
His silence agrees. I was considering a 4th strike, but Trudy's mood is dangerous. She might go on the attack and invite a dangerous response. After a pause, in mollifying mode, he says,
"We should run through it one last time."
"What about a lawyer?"
"Bit late now."
"Tell them we won't talk without one."
"Won't look good when they're only coming round for a chat."
"I hate this!"
"We should run through it one last time."
But they don't. Stupefied, they contemplate Chief Inspector Allison's approach. By now, within the hour could mean within the minute. Knowing everything, almost everything, I'm party to the crime, safe, obviously, from questioning, but fearful. And curious, impatient to witness the inspector's skills. An open mind could peel these two apart in minutes. Trudy betrayed by nerves, Claude by stupidity. I'm trying to place them, the morning coffee cups from my father's visit. Transferred, I now think, to wait unwashed by the kitchen sink. DNA on one cup will prove my mother and uncle to be telling the truth. The Danish debris must be close by.
"Quickly," says Claude at last. "Let's do this. Where did the row start?"
"In the kitchen."
"No, on the doorstep. What was it about?"
"Money."
"No, throwing you out. How long was he depressed?"
"Years."
"Months. How much did I lend him?"
"1,000.
5! Christ, Trudy!"
"I'm pregnant. It makes you dim."
"You said it yourself yesterday. Everything as it was, plus the depression, minus the smoothies, plus the row."
"Plus the gloves, minus he was moving back in."
"God, yes, again. What was he depressed about?"
"Us. Debts. Work. Baby."
"Good."
They go round a second time. By the third, it sounds better. What sickening complicity that I should wish them success.
"So say it, then."
"As it happened, minus the smoothies, plus the row and gloves, minus the depression, plus he was moving back in."
"No! Fuck! Trudy! As was, plus the depression, minus the smoothies, plus the row, plus the gloves, minus he was moving back in."
The doorbell rings and they freeze. "Tell them we're not ready." This is my mother's idea of a joke. or evidence of her terror. Muttering probable obscenities, Claude goes towards the videophone, changes his mind, and makes for the stairs and the front door. Trudy and I take a nervous shuffle around the kitchen. She too is muttering as she works on her story. Usefully, each successive effort of memory removes her further from the actual events. She's memorizing her memories. The transcription errors will be in her favor. They'll be a helpful cushion at first on their way to becoming the truth. She could also tell herself, she didn't buy the glycol, go to Judd Street, mix the drinks, plant stuff in the car, dump the blender. She cleaned up the kitchen, not against the law. Convinced, she'll be liberated from conscious guile and may stand a chance. The effective lie, like the masterly golf swing, is free of self-awareness. I've listened to the sports commentaries. I attend to and sift the descending footsteps. Chief Inspector Allison is light-boned, even bird-like for all her seniority. There are handshakes. From the sergeant's wooden, "How do you do?" I recognize the older man from yesterday's visit. What's blocked his promotion? Class, education, IQ, scandal? The last, I hope, for which he might take the blame and doesn't need my pity. The agile chief inspector sits at the kitchen table and invites us all to do the same, as if the house were hers. I imagine my mother thinking that she might more easily mislead a man. Allison spreads a folder and clicks repeatedly the spring-loaded button of her pen as she speaks. She tells us that the first thing to say, then pauses with great intensity of effect to look, I'm certain, deeply into Trudy and Claude's eyes, is how deeply sorry she is at this loss of a dear husband, dear brother, dear friend. No, dear father. I'm fighting a familiar, rising chill of exclusion. But the voice is warm, larger than her frame, relaxed in the burden of office. Her mild cockney is the very register of urban poise and won't be easily challenged. Not by my mother's expensively constrained vowels. No pulling that old trick. History has moved on. One day most British statesmen will speak like the chief inspector. I wonder if she has a gun. 2 grand. Like the Queen not carrying money. Shooting people as for sergeants and below. Allison explains that this is an informal conversation to help her form a fuller understanding of the tragic events. Trudy and Claude are under no obligation to answer questions. But she's wrong. They feel they are. To refuse will appear suspicious. But if the chief inspector is one move ahead, she may think that compliance is even more suspect. Those with nothing to hide would insist on a lawyer as a precaution against police error or unlawful intrusion. As we settle round the table, I note and resent the absence of polite queries about me. When's it due, boy or girl? Instead, the chief inspector wastes no time. You might show me around when we're done talking. More statement than request. Claude is eager, too eager, to comply. Oh, yes, yes. A search warrant would be the alternative, but there's nothing upstairs of interest to the police beyond the squalor. The chief inspector says to Trudy, Your husband came here yesterday about 10 a.m. That's right. Her tone is impassive, an example to Claude. And there was tension. Of course. Why, of course? I've been living with his brother in what John thought was his house. Whose house is it? It's the marital home. And the marriage was over. Yes. Mind if I ask, did he think it was over? Trudy hesitates. There may be a right and wrong answer. He wanted me back, but he wanted his women friends. Know any names? No. But he told you about them? No. But you knew, somehow. Of course I knew. Trudy allows herself a little contempt, as if to say, I'm the real woman here. But she's ignored Claude's coaching. She was to speak the truth, adding and subtracting only what was agreed. I hear my uncle stir in his chair. Without pause, Allison changes the subject. You had a coffee? Yes.
All three, round this table.
All three. This is Claude, worried perhaps that his silence is giving a poor impression.
Anything else? What?
With the coffee.
Did you offer him anything else? No.
My mother sounds cautious.
And what was in the coffee? Excuse me?
Milk, sugar.
He always had it black.
Her pulse rate has risen. But Claire Allison's manner is impenetrably neutral. She turns to Claude.
So you lent him money?
Yes.
How much?
5,000. Claude and Trudy answer in ragged chorus.
A check?
Cash, actually. It's how he wanted it.
Have you been to this juice bar on Judd Street?
Claude's answer is as quick as the question. Once or twice. It was John who told us about it.
You weren't there yesterday, I suppose?
No.
You never borrowed his black hat with a wide brim?
Never. Not my sort of thing.
This may be the wrong answer, but there's not time to work it out.
The questions have acquired new weight. Trudy's heart is beating faster. I wouldn't trust her to speak, but she does in a constricted voice.
Birthday present for me. He loved that hat.
The chief inspector is already moving on to something different, but she turns back.
It's all we can see of him on the CCTV. Sent it off for a DNA match. We haven't offered you any tea or coffee, Trudy says in her altered voice.
The chief inspector must have refused both for herself and the still silent sergeant with a shake of the head.
That's most of it these days, she says in a tone of nostalgia. Science and computer screens. Now, where was... Ah, yes, there was tension. But I see in the notes there was a row.
Claude will be making the same racing calculations as me. His own hair will be found in the hat. The correct answer was yes. He borrowed it a while ago.
Yes, Trudy says. One of many.
Would you mind telling me that
he wanted me to move out? I said I'd go in my own time.
When he drove off, what was his state of mind?
Not good. He was a mess. Confused. He didn't really want me to go. He wanted me back. Tried to make me jealous, pretending that Elodie was his lover. She put us right. There was no affair.
Too much detail. She's trying to regain control, but talking too fast. She needs to take a breath. Claire Allison is silent while we wait to know the next direction she'll take. But she stays with this and puts the matter as delicately as she can.
That's not my information.
A moment of numbness, as if sound itself has been murdered. The space around me shrinks as Trudy seems to deflate. Her spine slumps like an old woman's. I'm just a little proud of myself. I always had my suspicions. How eagerly they believed Elodie. Now they know. Nurse's flowers will certainly not last. But I should be cautious, too. The chief inspector might have her own reason to lie. She's clicking her ballpoint pen, ready to move on. My mother says in a small voice,
"Well, I suppose I was the more deceived."
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Cancross, but my sources are good. Let's just say that this is a complicated young woman." I could explore the theory that it's no bad thing for Trudy to be the injured party, to have corroboration for the story of her faithless husband, but I'm stunned. We're both stunned. My father, that uncertain principal, spins yet further away from me just as the chief inspector comes at my mother with another question. She answers in the same small voice, with the added tremor of a punished little girl.
Any violence? No. Threats? No.
None from you?
No. What about his depression? What can you tell me?
It's kindly said, and must be a trap, but Trudy doesn't pause. Too distraught to coin new lies, too persuaded of her truth, she falls back on all she said before in the same unlikely language. Constant mental pain, lashed out at those he loved, wrenched the poems from his soul. A vivid image comes to me of a parade of exhausted soldiers with ruined plumage, a sepia memory of a podcast, the Napoleonic Wars in many episodes, back when my mother and I were at ease. Oh, that Boney had stayed within his borders, I remember thinking, and gone on writing good laws for France. Claude joins in.
His own worst enemy.
The altered acoustic tells me that the chief inspector has turned to look directly at him. Any other enemies, apart from himself? The tone is unassuming. At best, the form of the question's light-hearted, at worst, fertile with sinister intent.
I wouldn't know. We were never close.
Tell me, she says, her voice now warmer, about your childhood together. That is, if you want to.
He does.
I was younger by 3 years. He was good at everything. Sports, studying, girls. He thought I was an insignificant scab. When I grew up, I did the only thing he couldn't. Make money.
Property.
That sort of thing.
The chief inspector turns back to Trudy.
Is this house for sale?
Certainly not.
I'd heard it was.
Trudy doesn't respond, her first good move in several minutes. I'm wondering if the chief inspector is in uniform. She must be. Her peaked hat will be by her elbow on the table, like a giant beak. I see her as free of mammalian sympathies, narrow-faced, thin-lipped, tight-buttoned. Surely her head nods pigeon-like when she walks. The sergeant thinks she's a stickler, bound for promotion out of his league. She'll fly. Either she's decided for John Cairncross's suicide, or she has reason to believe that a late third-term gravid is good cover for a crime. Everything the chief inspector says, the least remark, is open to interpretation. The only power we have is to project. She may, like Claude, be clever or stupid, or both at once. We just don't know. Our ignorance is her perfect hand. My guess is that she suspects little, knows nothing, that her superiors are watching, that she must be delicate because this conversation is irregular and could compromise due process, that she'll choose what's appropriate over what's true, that her career is her egg, and she'll sit on it, warm it, and wait. But I've been wrong before. 19. What next? Claire Allison wishes to look around. A bad idea. But to withdraw permission now, when, for all we know, things are going badly, will make them worse. The sergeant goes first up the wooden stairs, followed by Claude, the chief inspector, then my mother and me. On the ground floor, the chief inspector says that if we wouldn't mind, she'd like to go to the top and work down. Trudy doesn't care to climb more stairs. The others continue up, while we go into the sitting room to sit and think. I dispatch my light-footed thoughts ahead of them, first to the library. Plaster dust, a smell of death, but relative order. The floor above, bedroom and bathroom, chaos of an intimate kind, the bed itself a tangle of lust and broken sleep, the floor strewn or piled with Trudy's discarded clothes, the bathroom likewise with lidless pots, unguents, and dirty underwear. I wonder what disorder tells suspicious eyes. It can't be morally neutral. A contempt for things, for order, cleanliness, must lie on a spectrum with scorn for laws, values, for life itself. What is a criminal but a disordered spirit? However, excessive order in a bedroom might be suspicious too. The chief inspector, bright-eyed as a robin, will take it in at a glance and come away. But below the level of conscious thought, disgust might bend her judgment. There are rooms above the first floor, but I've never been so far. I bring my thoughts to ground, and, like a dutiful child, attend to my mother's state. Her heart rate has settled. She seems almost calm, perhaps fatalistic. Her engorged bladder presses against my head, but she can't be troubled to move. She's making her calculations, thinking, perhaps, of their plan. But she should ask herself where her interests lie. disassociate from Claude, land him in it somehow. No point in both doing time. Then she and I could languish here. She won't want to give me away when she's alone in a big house. In which case, I promise to forgive her, or deal with her later. But there's no time for schemes. I hear them coming back down. They pass by the open sitting-room door on their way to the front entrance. The chief inspector surely can't leave without a respectful goodbye to the bereaved wife. In fact, Claude has opened the front door and is showing Alison where his brother was parked, how the car failed to start at first, how, despite the row, they had waved when the engine turned and the car reversed into the road. A lesson in truth-telling. Then Claude and the police are before us.
Trudy? May I call you Trudy? Such a terrible time, and you've been so helpful. So hospitable. I can't...
The chief inspector breaks off, her attention distracted.
Were these your husband's?
She's looking at the cardboard boxes my father carried in and left under the bay window. My mother gets to her feet. If there's to be trouble, she'd better use her height and width.
He was moving back in, leaving Shoreditch. May I see? Just books. But go ahead.
There's a gasp from the sergeant as he goes down on his knees to open the boxes. I'd say the chief inspector is squatting on her haunches, not a robin now, but a giant duck. It's wrong of me to dislike her. She's the rule of law, and I count myself already in the court of Hobbes. The state must have its monopoly of violence. But the chief inspector's manner irritates me. The way she riffles through my father's possessions, his favourite books, while seeming to talk to herself, knowing we've no choice but to listen.
Beats me. Very, very sad. Right on the slip road.
Of course, this is a performance, a prelude. And sure enough, she stands. I think she's looking at Trudy, perhaps at me.
But the real mystery is this. Not a single print on that glycol bottle. Nothing on the cup. Just heard from forensics. Not a trace. So strange.
Ah, says Claude, but Trudy cuts across him.
I should warn her. She mustn't be too eager. Her explanation comes out too fast.
Gloves, skin complaint. He was so ashamed of his hands. Oh, the gloves, the chief inspector exclaims.
You're right. Clean forgot. She's unfolding a sheet of paper.
These?
My mother steps forward to look. It must be a printout of a photograph.
Yes. Didn't have another pair. Not like these. I used to tell him he didn't need them. No one really minded.
Wore them all the time?
No,
but a lot, especially when he was feeling down. The chief inspector is leaving, and that's a relief. We're all following her out into the hall.
Here's a funny thing. Forensics again. Phoned through this morning, and it went right out of my mind. Should have told you. So much else going on. Cuts to frontline services, local crime wave. Anyway, forefinger and thumb of the right glove. You'd never guess. A nest of tiny spiders. Scores of them. And, Trudy, you'll be pleased to know this. Baby's all doing well. Crawling already.
The front door is opened, probably by the sergeant. The chief inspector steps outside. As she walks away, her voice recedes and merges with the sound of passing traffic.
Can't for the life of me remember the Latin name. Long time since her hand was in that glove.
The sergeant lays a hand on my mother's arm and speaks at last, saying softly in parting,
"Back tomorrow morning. Clear up a last few things."
20. At last, the moment is on us. There are decisions to take, urgent, irreversible, self-damning. But first, Trudy needs 2 minutes of solitude. We hurry down to the basement, to the facility the humorous Scots call the Cludgy. There, as the pressure on my skull is relieved and my mother squats some seconds longer than is necessary, sighing to herself, my thoughts clarify, or take a new direction. I thought the murderers should escape for the sake of my liberty. This may be too narrow a view, too self-interested. There are other considerations. Hatred of my uncle may exceed love for my mother. Punishing him may be nobler than saving her. But it might be possible to achieve both. These concerns remain with me as we return to the kitchen. It appears that after the police left, Claude discovered that he needed a scotch. Hearing it poured from the bottle as we enter, a seductive sound, Trudy finds she needs one too. A big one. With tap water, half and half. Silently, my uncle complies. Silently, they stand facing each other by the sink. Not the moment for toasts. They're contemplating each other's errors, or even their own, or deciding what to do. This is the emergency they dreaded and planned for. They knock back their measures and, without speaking, settle for another. Our lives are about to change. Chief Inspector Allison looms above us, a capricious, smiling god. We won't know until it's too late why she didn't make the arrests just then, why she's left us alone. Rolling up the case, waiting for the DNA on the hat, moving on. Mother and uncle must consider that any choice they make now could be just the one she has in mind for them, and she's waiting. Just as possible, this, their mysterious plan, won't have occurred to her, and they could be one step ahead. One good reason to act boldly. Instead, for now, they prefer a drink. Perhaps whatever they do obliges Claire Allison, including an interlude with a single malt. But no, their only chance is to make the radical choice. And now. Trudy raises an arm to forestall a third. Claude is more steadfast. He's in strict pursuit of mental clarity. We listen to him pour. He's having it neat and long. Then we listen to him swallow hard, that familiar sound. They might be wondering how they can avoid a row just when they need a common purpose. From far away comes the sound of a siren, an ambulance merely, but it speaks to their fears. The latticework of the state lies invisibly across the city. Hard to escape it. It's a prompt, for at last there's speech, a useful statement of the obvious.
This is bad.
My mother's voice is croaky and low. Where are the passports?
I've got them. And the cash?
In my case. But they don't move. And the asymmetry of the exchange, Trudy's evasive reply, doesn't provoke my uncle. He's well into his third as Trudy's first reaches me. Hardly sensual, but it speaks or sinks to the occasion, to a sense of an ending with no beginning in sight. I conjure an old military road through a cold glen, a whiff of wet stone and peat, the sound of steel and patient trudging on loose rock, and the weight of bitter injustice. So far from the south-facing slopes, the dusty bloom on swelling purple clusters framing receding hills and their overlapping shades of ever-paler indigo. I'd rather be there. But I'm conceding. The scotch, my first, set something free. A harsh liberation. The open gate leads to struggle and fear of what the mind might devise. It's happening now, to me. I'm asking myself, what it is that I most want now. Anything I want. Realism not a limiting factor. Cut the ropes, set the mind free. I can answer without thinking. I'm going through the open gate. Footsteps on the stairs. Trudy and Claude look up, startled. Has the inspector found a way into the house? Has a burglar chosen the worst of all nights? This is a slow, heavy descent. They see black leather shoes, then a belted waist, a shirt stained with vomit, then a terrible expression, both blank and purposeful. My father wears the clothes he died in. His face is bloodless, the already rotting lips are greenish-black, the eyes tiny and penetrating. Now he stands at the foot of the stairs, taller than we remember him. He's come from the mortuary to find us, and knows exactly what he wants. I'm shaking, because my mother is. There's no shimmer, nothing ghostly. It's not an hallucination. This is my corporeal father, John Cairncross, exactly as he is. My mother's moan of fear acts as an enticement, for he's walking towards us.
John,
Claude says warily, on a rising note, as if he could wake this figure into proper non-existence.
John, it's us.
This seems well understood. He stands close before us, exuding a sweet miasma of glycol and maggot-friendly flesh. It's my mother he stares at, with small, hard, black eyes made of imperishable stone. His disgusting lips move, but he makes no sound. The tongue is blacker than the lips. Fixing his gaze on her all the while, he stretches out an arm. His fleshless hand fastens on my uncle's throat. My mother can't even scream. Still, the illiquid eyes remain on her. This is for her, his gift. The remorseless, one-handed grip tightens. Claude drops to his knees, his eyes are bulging, his hands beat and pull uselessly at his brother's arm. Only a distant squeaking. The piteous sound of a mouse tells us that he's still alive. Then he isn't. My father, who hasn't glanced at him once, lets him drop, and now draws his wife to him, enfolds her in arms that are thin and strong, like steel rods. He pulls her face towards his, and kisses her long and hard, with icy, putrefying lips. Terror and disgust and shame overwhelm her. The moment will torment her until she dies. Indifferently, he releases her and walks back the way he came. Even as he climbs the stairs, he begins to fade. Well, I was asked. I asked myself. And that's what I wanted. A childish Halloween fantasy. How else to commission a spirit revenge in a secular age? The Gothic has been reasonably banished, the witches have fled the heath, and materialism, so troubling to the soul, is all I have left. A voice on the radio once told me that when we fully understand what matter is, we'll feel better. I doubt that. I'll never get what I want. I emerge from reveries to find us in the bedroom. I've no memory of the ascent. The hollow sound of the wardrobe door, a clank of coat hangers, a suitcase lifted onto the bed, and another, then a brisk snap of locks opening. They should have packed in readiness. The inspector might even come tonight. Are they calling this a plan? I hear curses and muttering. Where is it? I had it here, in my hand. They crisscross the bedroom, open drawers, move in and out of the bathroom. Trudy drops a glass that shatters on the floor. She hardly cares. For some reason, the radio is on. Claude sits with his laptop and mumbles.
Train's at 9, taxi's on its way.
I'd prefer Paris to Brussels. Better onward connections. Trudy, still in the bathroom, mutters to herself. Dollars, euros. Everything they say, even the sounds they make, have an air of valediction, like a sadly resolving chord, a sung farewell. This is the end. We aren't coming back. The house, my grandfather's house I should have grown up in, is about to fade. I won't remember it. I'd like to summon a list of countries without extradition treaties. Most are uncomfortable, unruly, hot. I've heard that Beijing is a pleasant spot for runaways. A thriving village of English-speaking villains buried deep in the populated vastness of a world city. A fine place to end up.
Sleeping pills, painkillers,
Claude calls out. His voice, its tone, prompts me. Time to decide. He's closing up the cases, fastening leather straps, so quick. They must have been half-packed already. These are old-fashioned two-wheeled items, not four. Claude lifts them to the floor. Trudy says, "Which?" I think she's holding up two scarves. Claude grunts his choice. This is only a pretense of normality. When they board the train, when they cross the border, their guilt will declare itself. They only have an hour, and they should hurry. Trudy says there's a coat she wants and can't find. Claude insists she won't need it. "It's lightweight," she says. "The white one."
You'll stand out in a crowd on CCTV.
But she finds it anyway, just as Big Ben strikes 8 and the news comes on. They don't pause to listen. There are still last things to gather up. In Nigeria, children burned alive in front of their parents by keepers of the flame. In North Korea, a rocket is launched. Worldwide, rising sea levels run ahead of predictions. But none of these is first. That's reserved for a new catastrophe. A combination, poverty and war, with climate change held in reserve, driving millions from their homes, an ancient epic in new form, vast movements of people like engorged rivers in spring, Danubes, Rhines and Rhones of angry or desolate or hopeful people, crammed at borders against the razor wire gates, drowning in thousands to share in the fortunes of the West. If, as the new cliché goes, this is biblical, the seas are not parting for them, not the Aegean, not the English Channel. Old Europa tosses in her dreams. She pitches between pity and fear, between helping and repelling. Emotional and kind this week, scaly-hearted and so reasonable the next. She wants to help, but she doesn't want to share or lose what she has. And always, there are problems closer at hand. As radios and TVs everywhere drone on, people continue about their business. A couple has finished packing for a journey. The cases are closed. But there's a picture of her mother that the young woman wants to bring. The heavy carved frame is too large to pack. Without the right tool, the photograph can't be removed, and the tool, a special kind of key, is in the basement, deep in a drawer. A taxi waits outside. The train leaves in 55 minutes. The station is a good way off. There may be queues for security and passport control. The man carries a suitcase out to the landing and returns, a little out of breath. He should have made use of the wheels.
We absolutely have to go.
I've got to have this picture.
Carry it under your arm.
But she has a handbag, her white coat, a suitcase to tow, and me to carry. With a moan, Claude lifts the second suitcase to carry it out. By this unneeded effort, he's making a point about urgency.
It won't take you a minute. It's in a front corner of the left-hand drawer.
He returns.
Trudy, we're leaving. Now.
The exchange has grown from terse to bitter.
You carry it for me.
Out of the question.
Claude, it's my mother.
I don't care. We're leaving.
But they're not. After all my turns and revisions, misinterpretations, lapses of insight, attempts at self-annihilation, and sorrow in passivity, I've come to a decision. Enough. My amniotic sack is the translucent silk purse, fine and strong, that contains me. It also holds the fluid that protects me from the world and its bad dreams. No longer. Time to join in, to end the endings. Time to begin. It's not easy to free my right arm lodged tight against my chest, or gain movement in my wrist, but now it's done. A forefinger is my own special tool to remove my mother from the frame. 2 weeks early, and fingernails so long. I make my first attempt at an incision. My nails are soft, and, however fine, the fabric is tough. Evolution knows its business. I feel for the indent my finger made. There's a crease, well defined, and that's where I try again and again until the fifth attempt, when I feel the faintest rendering, and on the sixth, the tiniest rupture. Into this tear, I succeed in working the tip of my nail, my finger, then two fingers, three, four, and at last my bald fist punches through, and there follows behind it a great outpouring, the cataract at the beginning of life. My watery protection has vanished. Now I'll never know how the business of the photograph or the 9 o'clock train would have been resolved. Claude is outside the room at the head of the stairs. He'll have a case in each hand, ready to descend. My mother calls out with what sounds like a disappointed moan.
Oh, Claude!
What now?
My water's breaking!
We'll deal with it later, on the train.
He must believe it's a ploy, a continuation of the argument, a repellent form of womanly trouble that he's too frantic to consider. I'm shrugging off the call. My first experience of undressing. I'm clumsy. Three dimensions seem three too many. I foresee the material world will be a challenge. My discarded shroud remains twisted round my knees. No matter. I've new business below my head. I don't know how I know what to do. It's a mystery. There's some knowledge we simply arrive with. In my case, there's this, and a smattering of poetic scansion. No blank slate, after all. I bring that same hand to my cheek, and slide further along the muscular wall of the uterus to reach down and find the cervix. It's a tight squeeze against the back of my head. It's there, at the opening to the world, that I delicately palpate with puny fingers, and immediately, as if some spell has been uttered, the great power of my mother is provoked. The walls around me ripple, then tremble, and close in on me. It's an earthquake. It's a giant stirring in her cave. Like the sorcerer's apprentice, I'm horrified, then crushed, by the strength that's unleashed. I should have waited my turn. Only a fool would mess with such force. From far away, I hear my mother call out. It could be a shout for help, or a scream of triumph or pain. And then I feel it on the top of my head. My crown, 1 centimeter dilated. No turning back. Trudy has crawled onto the bed. Claude is somewhere near the door. She's panting, excited, and very afraid.
It started. It's so quick. Get an ambulance.
He says nothing for a moment. Then he asks simply, "Where's my passport?" The failure is mine. I underestimated him. The point in arriving early was to ruin Claude. I knew he was trouble, but I thought he loved my mother and would stay with her. I'm beginning to understand her fortitude. Over the bright jingling sound of coins against mascara case as he rummages through her handbag, she says,
"I hid it. Downstairs. Just in case this happened."
He considers. He's dealt in property. He owned a skyscraper in Cardiff and knows about a deal. "Tell me where it is and I'll call you an ambulance. Then I'll go." Her voice is cautious. Closely observing her own state, waiting for, wanting, and dreading the next wave.
"No. If I'm going down, so are you."
"Fine. No ambulance."
"I'll call them myself.
As soon..." As soon as the second contraction, stronger than the first, has passed. Again, her involuntary shout, and the whole body clenching, as Claude crosses the room to the bed, to the locker at its side, to disconnect the phone, while I'm violently compressed and lifted, sucked down and backwards an inch or two from my resting place. An iron band around my head is tightening. Our three fates are being crushed in one more. As the wave recedes, Claude, like a border official, says dully, "Passport?" She shakes her head. Waits to get her breath. They hold each other in a form of equilibrium. She recovers and says in a level voice,
"Then you'll have to be the midwife."
"Not my baby."
"It's never the midwife's baby."
She's frightened, but she can terrify him with instructions.
"When it comes out, it'll be face down. You'll pick it up, both hands, very gently, supporting the head, and place it on me. Still face down. Between my breasts. Near my heartbeat. Don't worry about the cord. It'll stop beating on its own and the baby will start to breathe. You'll put a couple of towels over it to keep it warm. Then we wait."
"Wait? Christ, for what?"
"For the placenta to be born."
If he flinched or retched, I don't know. His calculation might still be that we could get this over with and catch a later train. I listen closely, intent on learning what to do. Duck under a towel, breathe, don't say a word. But it? Surely pink or blue?
"So go and get a pile of towels. It'll be messy. Scrub your hands with a nail brush and lots of soap." So far out of his depth, so far from a friendly shore,
a man without his papers who should be on the run. He turns to go and do what he's told. So it continues, wave on wave, shouts and wails, and pleas for the agony to cease. Unmerciful progress, relentless ejection. The cord unreels behind me as I make my slow way forward. Forward and out. Pitiless forces of nature intend to flatten me. I travel a section where I know a portion of my uncle has passed too often the other way. I'm not troubled. What was in his day a vagina is now proudly a birth canal, my Panama, and I'm greater than he was, a stately ship of genes, dignified by unhurried progress, freighted with my cargo of ancient information. No casual cock can compete. For a stretch I'm deaf, blind and dumb. It hurts everywhere. But it pains my screaming mother more as she renders the sacrifice all mothers make for their big-headed, loud-mouthed infants. A slithering moment of waxy, creaking emergence. And here I am. Set naked on the kingdom. Like stout Cortez, I remember a poem my father once recited. I'm amazed. I'm looking down, with what wonder and surmise, at the napped surface of a blue bath towel. Blue. I've always known, verbally at least, I've always been able to infer what's blue. Sea, sky, lapis lazuli, gentians, mere abstractions. Now, I have it at last. I own it, and it possesses me. More gorgeous than I dared believe. That's just a beginning, at the indigo end of the spectrum. My faithful cord, the lifeline that failed to kill me, suddenly dies its allotted death. I'm breathing. Delicious. My advice to newborns, don't cry. Look around. Taste the air. I'm in London. The air is good. Sounds are crisp, brilliant with the treble turned up. The lambent towel, beaming its colour, summons the Goashad Mosque in Iran that made my father cry at dawn. My mother stirs and causes my head to turn. I have a glimpse of Claude, smaller than I cast him, with narrow shoulders and a foxy look. No mistaking an expression of disgust. Evening sunlight through a plane tree throws a stirring pattern on the ceiling. Ah, the joy of straightening my legs! Of noting from the alarm clock on the bedside table that they'll never make their train. But I don't have long to savour the moment. My pliant ribcage is clamped by the squeamish hands of a killer, and I'm placed on the snowy, soft, welcoming belly of another. Her heartbeat is distant, muffled, but familiar, like an old chorus not heard in half a lifetime. The music's marking is andante, a delicate footfall leading me to the true open gate. I can't deny the dread I feel, but I'm dead beat, a shipwrecked sailor on a lucky beach. I'm falling, even as the ocean licks around my ankles. Trudy and I must have dozed. I don't know how many minutes have passed until we hear the doorbell. How clear it sounds. Claude is still here, still hoping for his passport. He may have been downstairs to hunt. Now he goes towards the videophone. He glances at the screen and turns away. There can be no surprises. Four of them, he says, more to himself. We contemplate this. It's over. It's not a good end. It was never going to be. My mother moves me so we can exchange a long look. The moment I've waited for. My father was right. It is a lovely face.